A new memorial in Alabama honors those who died at the hands of brutal lynch mobs. From the late 1800s through the middle of the 20th century, lynching was a widespread form of racial violence in the South. But many racially motivated killings during that time were not officially lynchings, and many of these stories risk being forgotten. WUNC military reporter Jay Price retraced the story of one of those cases, a soldier visiting Durham in the 1940s who was shot and killed by a bus driver. Jay Price joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Jay.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about first of all, let's talk about the definition of lynching. We know there's a great deal of racial violence. This enforces the theory of white supremacy that maintain privilege for white people. Without violence, it can't happen. That's lynching. How is that different from the kind of racial violence you're talking about?
Well, you know, when I got started looking at this thing, I actually was looking at lynching. So I was deeply interested in, you know, when I heard about that new memorial, which is just striking, by the way, I wondered about veterans who were lynched. There were a number of cases, and when you read up on the details, it becomes clear that their veteran status played a big part in the fact that they were lynched. It made them targets in many cases. And their time in service, especially in World War II, empowered some of these victims, leading them to come back and do things like vote, things that prompted Southern whites who wanted to maintain that status quo to kill them. I'm doing a separate story on a couple of cases of those. And we had cases in North Carolina where veterans were being held down basically and killed for just simply laughing at a bus stop, for example. So, you know, one of the things you have to do to kind of understand how I got onto this is understand how that lynching memorial is designed. Each county where there are lynchings, and there were several hundred, has its own big steel column. And these columns dangle from the roof rather than support it. And each county's column bears the names of those who were killed. Well, I'd read about this particular case in Durham, which really caught my attention, and noticed there wasn't a column for Durham County. I mean, I was raised in the Triangle, and I never heard of this case, and, you know, it was just compelling.
You mean the memorial in Alabama memorializes lynchings all across the country, so you might have expected to see something from Durham.
Yeah.
So tell us about the case, then, in Durham.
Well, you had a young, he wasn't that young for a soldier, but he was 34 years old, Private Booker T. Spicely. He was born in Virginia, but had lived his adult life in Philadelphia. And he was stationed at Camp Butner, which was a major Army training camp not far from Durham. It's now essentially defunct. But back then, there were tens of thousands of soldiers there, and the black soldiers would often come into Durham on weekend pass. The white soldiers would too, but Durham was a major capital, essentially, for black Americans of that era.
Well, particularly because of the Hayti district in Durham. And so he's here from essentially having been raised in Philadelphia. And you spoke with Margaret Burnham, who's the director of the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern University, about these kind of incidents. Again, people coming from other parts of the country. This happens during the war as people are stationed, African-American soldiers stationed in the South. And she talked a little bit about what it meant to try to understand and learn the rules of segregation, Jim Crow in the South.
Many soldiers who encountered violence as they moved across the South. Many of these soldiers were from the North and were not accustomed to the Jim Crow rules. It's also true that the rules changed from place to place, so you had to learn the rules of the particular locale where you were traveling, whether you were stationed nearby or whether you were passing through or whether you were visiting. You had to learn the rules all over again.
All right, that's Margaret Burnham, the director of Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern University. She spoke with WUNC military reporter Jay Price, who's talking about a story of racially motivated killing in Durham in the 1940s. One of those people who may or may not have known the rules was Private Booker T. Spicely.
Yeah, and so being from the North, while intellectually he, of course, understood the Jim Crow laws, like the issue on buses where you had to ride in the back if you were black, he hadn't been living in places where you were kind of steeped in that code of behavior that Southerners were raised in. If you were black, you were always needing to be meek and subservient so that the closest white guy with a gun didn't use it on you. And, you know, understand what Dr. Burnham was talking about, there isn't a minor thing. By 1944, black soldiers, especially from the North, were showing unhappiness about white attitudes in the South and the so-called Jim Crow laws that treat them as inferior. And some of the white officers at Camp Butner apparently encouraged them. There were actually several signs of rebellion already by this point. At one point, soldiers from the camp overturned buses that were bringing them into Durham because when it came time for weekend leave, white soldiers got dibs and would fill all the buses. So they turned over a couple. There was a minor riot after a black soldier and a white liquor store clerk in Haytag got into an argument. And in Oxford, the police chief locked up a black soldier, and 60 other soldiers from the camp came over to demand his release. The police chief brought out a belt-fed machine gun to turn them away. And so, you know, against this backdrop, like hundreds of other soldiers, Private Spicely was coming into Durham to the famed Haytag community when he was on leave from the base.
All right, and Tim Tyson, who is a Southern historian, covers this story in his book, Democracy Betrayed, and he picks up the story from there.
Next stop, two white soldiers get onto the bus. And when, as they're coming onto the bus, Spicely says, this man, gesturing to the driver, this man says, I have to go to the back of the bus. But aren't I wearing the same uniform that you're wearing? Aren't I as good to stop a bullet as you are? Why should I have to go to the back of the bus? This guy, should he be able to tell me to go back to the back of the bus? And interestingly, and I don't know what happened between them, but the two white soldiers go to the back and sit in the colored section. So Spicely wants to go back there with them and continue the conversation, I assume. But as he's going, he says back to the bus driver, if you weren't 4F, you wouldn't be driving this bus.
It's Tim Tyson, a historian and an author on the murder of Booker T. Spicely, a private who was shot and killed in Durham in the 1940s. Pick up the story from there, Jay Price.
Well, you know, I read the newspaper accounts of the testimony during the trial that happened afterwards, and they varied. There were any number of witnesses. There were witnesses off the bus. There were a large number of riders who saw much of what went on, heard much of what went on. There was a lot of difference about exactly what was said on the bus, but the upshot of it was that Spicely went to the back of the bus, continued some dialogue with the driver, and questioned his 4F status. He was, like, apparently physically unfit for service in the military, which was, you know, essentially an insult then, terrible thing, to kind of mock someone for that. But I think that there's pretty firm agreement that one thing that Spicely did when it came time for him to get off of the bus was apologize to the driver and said he didn't intend to offend him. Spicely then, at his stop, gets off of the exit in the rear. There were two doors to the bus. He got off the one in the rear. The driver hopped up, pulled a .38 pistol out from underneath the seat, jumped out onto the sidewalk, ran around, shot Spicely once. Spicely doubled over a bit. He stepped back and shot Spicely again. Close enough where there were burn marks on his uniform, shot him through the dog tags. I mean, the very symbol of his identity as a soldier serving his country. And he collapsed on the sidewalk. The driver, Herman Council, gets back in the bus, completes his route. Eventually turned himself into police, but he completed his route. You know, it's almost a casual thing, way too casual. But police officers come up. They find Spicely collapsed on the sidewalk. They hand him over to military police, who carry him to the local, to the nearest hospital, which was a white-only hospital. They weren't going to treat him, they said, but they did take the time to sample his blood for blood alcohol content, which, not a good thing. It delayed him, and the police then took him to Duke Hospital, where he died shortly after arrival.
What's the reaction in the community?
It was messy. Now, almost immediately after the shooting, about an hour, hour and a half later, a white-owned warehouse and caught fire, and then essentially a whole block of warehouses burned to the ground. It attracted thousands of spectators. You know, they didn't have the internet or television going very much back then, so this was entertainment. Tyson is firmly convinced that this was at least in part a protest killing.
So, and you also talked to Mickey Meshaw, who is a state representative, Mickey Meshaw, who was in Durham at the time, and talked to him about what he remembers.
It didn't turn into a riot. Let me put it that way. People talked about it, and people talk angrily about it. Just things like, you know, it's a shame that it had to happen to a colored soldier who was fighting for their country and got no respect from white folks.
North Carolina Representative Mickey Meshaw talking to WNC military reporter Jay Price. What happens now in the legal process?
Well, the bus driver is arrested. Duke Power bails him out not once but twice. They pay the bond. The Duke Power owned the bus line back then in the city. And then there was this kind of debate, both at kind of a national level and a local level, about how to approach getting justice, a debate within the black community. Nationally, the black NAACP wanted to send in their attorneys. They were interested in doing that and trying to see if they could get some justice here. I mean, anywhere in the South, if you're going to get an all-white jury, which is what it was going to be, to convict a white man for killing a black man, it might well have been Durham. They wanted to send someone in. The very conservative black local leadership of the time said, no, we don't want this. You know, they'll be seen as outside agitators, and it will be less likely to get justice.
Meanwhile, and Tim Tyson is reporting at the same time that those leaders in Durham, the local leaders, had assurances from the local white establishment that justice would be done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you guarantee a verdict one way or the other, but they claimed that it would be a fair trial and they would get a pretty good shot at a conviction here. Instead, what happened was you had an all-white male jury go out and 28 minutes later came back and acquitted the driver.
His claim was it was self-defense, right?
His claim was a self-defense. This is a pretty common claim, though, in these cases. Any sort of case of kind of racially motivated killing back then, often you'd have if a white man was accused or brought in even for trial, he would often say, well, you know, he was reaching in his pocket or he was going back in the house to get something. How would you jump out of a bus and confront someone on the sidewalk, at a great distance from your driver's seat? And say that was in self-defense. Yeah, he said he was reaching in his pockets. The police found nothing in his pockets. They found no weapons. His hands were out of his pockets when the police found him on the sidewalk.
This case illustrates two key points, one of which you've touched on, which was the growing militancy and expectation among African-American soldiers in particularly who had fought and many had died for democracy. For those who returned, it was time to get some of the democracy that they fought for overseas. And this propelled this segment of the civil rights movement, as you say, and it also terrified Southern whites. So you can talk a little bit more about that and the idea of men and, to some extent, women in uniform coming back and insisting on their rights.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one way to kind of think of all of this, the War Department sent an investigator down to investigate this case. I've seen the declassified records of that. And essentially it was an informant. It was a black informant who insinuated himself into the community. And he was here to look for unrest. There was a great worry among members of the federal government that the black population would stir things up on the domestic front while we were at war overseas. And Hitler and the Japanese were kind of playing to this, apparently dropping propaganda leaflets about lynchings, of course. So one way to look at American history is we weren't really on the world stage in a big way until World War II and after. And one of the things that we got cornered into doing by these propaganda leaflets, by these terribly kind of racist regimes in these other countries we were fighting, was we got kind of forced into being kind of the world scold for essentially treating everyone the same.
Right. And particularly in the Cold War, when we're pointing at communist totalitarian regimes, and here we are doing the same thing to our own people at home.
Yeah, but we got dragged into it reluctantly. Right. You know, the white government was not happy with this, but you know, they were kind of forced into it.
Only left you 30 seconds for this, but the other part of this is, of course, these are stories that are not included in the stories of lynchings, per se. These are stories that may be forgotten.
Yeah, and that's why Dr. Burnham's investigators are doing what they do. And they did a thorough job of pulling together the remaining records on this, but I wanted to look at it too, some of the broader context. It had so much going for it as a story. The legacy of Haiti and black leadership in Durham, the racial dynamics of military service in World War II, the effect of service on black veterans who did really accelerate the civil rights movement. And here you got Booker Spicely. He gave his life essentially because he protested the Jim Crow bus law 11 years before the national climate was ready for Rosa Parks to have the effect that she did when she gave up her bus seat or refused to give up her bus seat to that white man.
Jay Price is WUNC's military reporter. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, writer and performer Kane Smigo takes us inside his new one-man show, A Hip-Hop Odyssey Through Race and Identity. Stay with us on The State of Things.